Oh, we are speaking truth to power about the 60 Scoop, Huawei, and Uber. But before we get to all that, I would like to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh Nations. And rather than keeping this as a tokenistic gesture to the Indigenous people of Canada, as is generally done on UBC's campus, we will keep the Indigenous struggle for self-determination and justice at the forefront of our consciousness. We will begin this show and every show until there is justice for Indigenous people talking about colonialism. So, Ajit, welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
You were missed dearly. Happy holidays to you as well. Congratulations on finishing. Merry Christmas. No, there's a war on Christmas, actually, according to conservatives and white people everywhere.
It's like 10 years deep.
And it turns out that the Christmas people are winning. They got Baby It's Cold Outside back on the radio. Christmas is up 1-0 in the war this year. That's huge.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm done exams. You're done exams. Congratulations.
Oh, yeah.
And it's nice to move forward. So that's the good news. So here's the bad news. unfortunately, from the 1960s to the 1980s, thousands of Indigenous children were taken from their homes. So this is a CBC News article from December 17th, yesterday. The headline reads, "Saskatchewan's apology for 60 Scoop is just the tip of the iceberg," says one survivor. The article reads, "Premier Scott Moe will apologize to 60 Scoop survivors early in the new year, but there will be no monetary compensation. The apology is scheduled for Monday, January 7th at 10 a.m. Central Standard Time in the rotunda of the Legislature Building. It will be preceded by a pipe ceremony. The announcement comes following a series of 6 sharing circles across the province that were held to inform the government of Saskatchewan's apology. These sharing circles were coordinated by the 60 Scoop Indigenous Survivors of Saskatchewan with support from the government of Saskatchewan." So the 60 Scoop Indigenous Survivors of Saskatchewan, SSISS, their board member and survivor Rod Bellinger said he was surprised with the early January date. "I thought it was very short notice because we did have a different date in mind." He said early January will be tough for many survivors to get to Regina to see the apology in person. Bellinger said the sharing circles helped move this process forward. "I think the talking circles were a great impact on the people that we were able to reach," he said, but added they wanted to reach many more and hope there will be more sharing circles in other communities. "It's part of our process in allowing survivors to regain their voice with what happened to them during this time." So what happened during this time? So the 60 Scoop once again saw thousands of Indigenous children taken from their homes from the 1960s to the 1980s and placed with white families. This was an act of genocide, as we've alluded to earlier, that is against what the UN defines as genocide, which is removing children from their families and breaking apart families. Doing that intentionally is an act of genocide. So who did this? This was, of course, the Canadian state. How long ago was it? Was it the 1860s? No. Was it the 1760s? No, shockingly, it was the 1960s, the 1980s, where this was very common practice. So that's kind of how screwy our country is and how recent these wounds are and how they really haven't been truly, in my opinion, reconciled in any way, shape, or form. What do you think about the 60 Scoop, Ajit?
Right. I mean, I think it's just another kind of facet of that whole program that they were doing with residential schools about forced assimilation, which is a euphemism for cultural genocide, obviously. And I think a lot of the white families that they put them in were like really hardcore Catholic families, very strict Christian upbringing, you know, corporal punishment. I mean, that's another euphemism for just child abuse. Right.
Yeah. And child abuse from your parents is okay.
Right. And I think I wouldn't doubt if, like, you know, sexual abuse was also pretty rampant then too. And, you know, again, I think we've discussed this topic before, right? It's just really important to highlight it because, you know, for those people, you know, think Indigenous people just get handouts, you know, not really. When they do deserve compensation for something which did happen to them factually, historically recorded, no, they don't get it.
Yeah, no, of course not, because when real genocide affects these people, not like this imaginary white genocide that's going on in South Africa, totally like made up thing, but when there's a real genocide going on in our own country, We don't have to get on a plane and do any volunteerism to go to Africa, to go to China, to go to wherever, you know, Asia, wherever bad things are happening. No, it's actually right here, and it wasn't that long ago. And so, like then in the 1960s, Indigenous children were overrepresented in the child welfare system, and that is also the case today.
Right.
So when, you know, we're talking about the 60s scoop, we're not talking about it as a past phenomenon, like it's all over and all the wounds are healed. Well, unfortunately, not only are the wounds not healed, which is why there is this apology happening in Saskatchewan, which is progress, but unfortunately, the things that led to this happening, which is settler colonialism, forcing Indigenous people off their lands, the genocide of Indigenous people, like just the straight up brutal murder of them, if not like starving them and depriving them of resources,
right,
happened then and it happens today. So it's more of this, like, the 60s scoop is, it's kind of a misleading title because it's like, you think it's just the 60s.
Right.
But it's more of just like one, like, blip on the map of the, like, genocide that Canada's kind of put on for Indigenous people.
Right. I guess it's more important in showing how the nature of the genocide changed. It shifted more hardcore, explicit, overt, in your face kind of abuse to this is really in your face.
It is in your face, but it's not like killing them.
It's weird. It's kind of this you're putting them in like the cradle of the state, and like you're kind of making them like subject of the state, and it's a really twisted way of kind of making them dependent on the state, and then, you know, coming full circle.
Oh, and then being like, oh my god, I can't believe they're dependent on us, right. Even though it's like that was like par for the course since like you started this whole thing. So
right.
Talking numbers. So in 1964, the number of Indigenous children in provincial care in British Columbia, 1,466, was over 50 times more than it had been in 1951, which was only 29 people. So, and the reason why this happened was because there was obviously, you know, problems in their community. So there's more children put in the child welfare system. And of course, you know, if the really good hearted and like the really benevolent, you know, child welfare people see some child, quote unquote, living in poverty, you know, rather than obviously deal with the roots of the problem, which is the poverty that the families come from, they just take their children away and put them in a better family or a good situation.
Right.
And that's how they moved so many kids from point A to point B, was taking kind of like, it's like it almost gives like a kind of a, if you have like a really reactionary point of view and you see like, oh, there's a poor kid living in poor conditions, we must take them into good conditions. That makes sense if obviously you rip this completely of any historical context, any racial context, any like colonial context, then that makes sense. Yeah, but like now that you understand that there was an Indigenous genocide starting in like the 1500s until the present day,
right,
and the reason why these people are in poverty is because they've been discriminated against by like private entities, public entities, discriminated completely by Canadian society, and they end up on the margins of society. When on the margins, obviously you're not living large.
No.
You have very like far and few between resources, very like low access to even like clean drinking water. And so when you have people from the state showing up and being like, hey, you know, this is not safe for kids, we need to take them away, although it appears, you know, really like kind-hearted or at least like a good idea, it's not. So, and that's like me giving the best case scenario for it. Most of these cases were just that, oh, they're native, so we just should just take them away so they can grow up civilized, which was the bulk of these people. And the number, the Indigenous and Northern Affairs Canada, they indicate that the number of Indigenous children adopted between 1960 and 1990 was 11,132.
Right.
More recent research suggests upwards of more than 20,000 First Nations, Métis and Inuit children were removed from their homes. Many children were sent abroad, some as far away as New Zealand. And depending on the source, in 1981 alone, 45 to 55% of children were adopted by American families. So this was like creating a diaspora of Indigenous people. It was not only were they uprooted from their traditional lands, you know, where they would have like stories for like what the mountains meant or like the river, and you know, like they really were attached to the land, like they really built their society
on
the land, which makes sense, I would hope. You know, that you would be rooted in where you live, in your community. And they completely just obliterated that through this system.
Right. It's just thinking big picture, it's actually really amazing, just the thought that came to my head, this kind of project that, you know, of course the comparisons with the United States is endless, and them being the monolith that they are, you know, just speak that gigantic state, we can just point to every kind of wrong that they did, but we kind of have our own project going on, and this was kind of the relationship, this is where the very personal relationship between the colonial state, what we like to describe as like the white settler colonial state, and it's very interesting in the manner that they treat indigenous people, and that we're going to force them to be civilized.
Yeah.
But in that same time, we're going to destroy them.
Yeah, exactly. And like, so, well, of course, like civilized is just, it doesn't mean that like they have like a high quality of life. It just means they conform to like whiteness. And
right.
Not whiteness is not white people. So calm down, white listeners. Right. We're not speaking about white people. Okay. It's actually technically not even the color of your skin.
No.
You know, it's like I don't know how to describe that color, but it's not white. No one's white or black. Okay.
Right.
No one is that. We're all human beings here. And what we mean by whiteness is our Western cultural beliefs. Yeah. And before anyone starts thinking, oh, it's the way it is, you got to understand that there's many other ways of constructing a society rather than maybe ours, which is at the end of the day, the most important thing is profit and, you know, the domination of others and
right.
the exchange of commodities to other people. It was, spirituality, you know, self-discovery, building a community, find, you know, like for indigenous people, like there was like beautiful art and culture, and that was where they mostly focused their identity on, rather than exploiting each other through capitalism like us Westerners do. So civilization and civilized, it does not mean like organized human society, because under that, indigenous people have been doing that for far longer than Europeans. Since time immemorial,
right.
They've been doing that. They actually had the first constitution in the upper New York, on southern Ontario, Great Lakes area, the Haudenosaunee. A constitution in North America. So if that's what you mean by having an organized state or even a constitution, then technically indigenous people were more civilized
right.
than the settlers. But of course, that's not what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I just try to draw those distinctions out, because it's, you know, before anybody just starts taking people at their word that like, oh yeah, they live differently than us. They're uncivilized. Like, no.
Right.
They do live differently. Yes. But it's just as complex of a society as white society, except white society never bothered to learn about indigenous society for what we've discussed earlier on the show, mainly resources is what it came down to, land and whatever they could exploit from
right.
the land. So, and I like your parallel between America and Canada, where, you know, where we're two different countries,
mm-hmm.
but we are in lockstep on how we deal with indigenous people.
Right.
Which is really poorly and destroying families. So
they were like our minority to exploit to that
yeah.
extent.
We didn't have black slaves.
That's
so
kind of fair, right?
That kind of like muddied up their waters, so to speak, like where they had like more racial division.
Right.
Here in Canada, it's like very like apparent, which is probably why, you know, amongst other reasons why Truth and Reconciliation is already coming up in our society, because, you know, it's pretty hard to ignore that the, you know, indigenous people are super exploited and really oppressed by our society. So,
right.
Yeah. But yeah, as far as the 60 Scoop is concerned, taking away people from their parents, what that does, obviously, is remove them completely from their cultural upbringing. You know, they become confused in their identity. And as Ajit explained earlier, leaves people open to abuse. Because obviously, as being part of adopted parents, even though if they, whether or not they wanted to have the child, a lot of reports would come out that's basically saying how, you know, the survivors of the 60 Scoop would talk about how their adoptive parents view their indigeneity, the fact that they're indigenous, as a negative, but even worse, as something that they needed to like work their way, get them out of. And they needed to constantly shun them and condemn them for their own identity. And furthermore, it would be, I was listening to a podcast by Ryan McMahon called, Thunder Bay. Really good. Must
right.
listen to. Got to check it out. By Canadaland. Great, great, great program.
Right.
And they were talking about how people growing up after being adopted and from indigenous communities to white communities, even to this day, are talked about if they have like a negative behavior, say they act out or they're, you know, getting high strung or just something that every normal person does. They'll be like, oh, that's the native in them. And it's like that like racial essentialism that like continues to this day that people are still like really stuck on.
Right.
I feel at least that like there's like certain things that are like, oh, that's just what Native people do. You know, like that's just kind of like how people see it, in right. my opinion, at least.
Right.
Yeah. As far as what the legacy of this is, it's great that there's this, apology. That's great for it to be at least recognized in the public record, and that like politicians are saying something about it, and at least acknowledging that that is happening. But it's really not far enough, because it's not undoing like the roots of this problem.
Right.
This is merely a reaction to like one of the many, many, many tactics used to push settler colonialism and like continue that project of displacing indigenous people from their land, and as well as inflicting violence and genocide upon them.
Mm-hmm.
So in my opinion, it would be more productive to really address undoing colonialism, which would require decolonization, which obviously the very powerful business interests that own our government and operate and pull the strings are completely against, and the reason being is that they would lose out on their really really lucrative deals, like in big energy. We saw the whole fight between Kinder Morgan and indigenous communities and their lack of consultation. And it's I bring it up not because it's, you know, some like tangent I like to go on, but because they're interlocked. And like the indigenous communities, although they've been trying to exterminate them and trying to destroy them, and through tactics like residential schools, the 60s scoop, amongst like overt violence,
right,
they continue to this day, and they're a thorn in the side of corporations, but they are also human beings right. that should have a dignified existence, but instead are like keep continuing to like the 2018 scoop and the 2018 sterilizations that we reported on a couple right. weeks ago, and they're basically like the front line against corporations that are trying to destroy the planet.
Right.
It's a really screwed up picture that we're in.
Right. I mean, it comes full circle, and I think that's the best part. The silver lining, I mean.
It really is, yeah. That if there is a silver lining to this, is that indigenous people still remain strong to this day and are still resisting. They're not just lying down and taking it, and that's why these apologies are happening, is through activism by indigenous communities and indigenous groups. So, you know, it's hard to believe that after all the trauma and all the violence that was inflicted upon them, whether or not by like, you know, personal violence from just people on the street, like throwing stuff at them or calling them racial slurs, or if it's state sponsored violence, like the 60s scoop or residential schools, here they are still standing up for themselves, still fighting to this day.
Right.
After hundreds of years of genocide. So nothing but applause and, you know, solidarity with these people as they keep fighting back against a far more powerful opponent than they are, the Canadian state. So, yeah. Any thoughts, Ajit?
No, I just, you know, totally agree with everything you've said. And, you know, the assessment's going to be the same every week, you know, show us otherwise. You know,
yeah.
The record states the fact.
Yeah, it's nice that, like, truth and reconciliation happened and that there's some movement forward. But as you can see, the good barely makes a dent on the bad.
With the election coming up, maybe Trudeau might start pandering to him. Right?
No, he will for sure, and we'll cover that when it happens.
Right.
The really cynical move. But that's basically what you get. So it doesn't matter if you vote liberal, conservative. It's going to be the same. They're just going to treat indigenous people like shit. So that's unfortunately where we're at. We're going to have to take a short break for commercials, but then we'll be right back to discuss the latest updates from the Huawei debacle. So we'll be right back in a second.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smokey every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my drink, It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine, Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from UMass Green Territory. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
What's up?
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And we are picking up where we left off with the Huawei debacle. How did this enter our lives? Well, Vancouver was hosting Meng Zheng, I struggle to pronounce her last name, the CFO of Huawei, a telecom giant from China. Our own government arrested her, detained her at YVR International Airport, sent her to that horrible Maple Ridge Women's Prison where they ironically also kept Gene Swanson for a day because Gene Swanson was protesting us the pipeline. So that's where they put people, I guess. And on top of that, she is currently the only CFO that has broken rank with the Iran sanctions, but that has ended up in jail. So when JP Morgan Chase does business with Iran, don't go to jail.
Right.
If any other corporations do business, even American or not, do business with Iran and violate the sanctions, which were dubious to begin with, they don't get put in jail. However, when it comes to a Chinese telecom giant, Huawei's CFO, and the daughter of the owner, she ends up in a Canadian jail. So, obviously, there's lots of politics involved with that, and we're going to try to get to the bottom of it and see and kind of sift through the many narratives going along here. So, we talked about last week how the sanctions in the U.S., U.S.-Iran struggle conflict that's been going on since the Iranian Revolution 1979 was basically caused by the CIA and the United States in order to protect British Petroleum, the company that was operating and owning Iran's oil fields at the time. So democratically elected, I forget his title, but he was basically the leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. He was democratically elected once again. Yes, democracy. The thing that America is trying to, you know, really trying to push, apparently, allegedly.
Gotta bring it to the Middle East.
Yeah, bring it. They brought it to Iraq with the U.S. Army and just completely destroyed the country and created ISIS.
That worked out great.
But when Iran engages in actual democracy and the
in
people.
In the 50s, too.
Exactly. So that just shows you how regressive the United States involvement is. As soon as the United States, it's like a death touch, the kiss of death to a functioning society is U.S. involvement with your politics. So the Iranians vote Mohammad Mossadegh in. He nationalizes BP's oil fields. Naturally, British Petroleum gets very upset. They contact,
Big Brother.
Yeah, they go to the MI6 to do something about it. The MI6 and the CIA work together, the two intelligence agencies of Britain and America, and they stage a coup. And it's public. It's I'm not making this up.
Don't forget, Israel was involved too.
Yeah, Israel was involved. They had a very vested interest in the region, as does all these people, to take away a hegemon's power like Iran, and just to keep their lackey in there, the Shah, and he was an autocrat, and it didn't really matter to the Americans because they opposed democracy in Iran and went with dictatorship because I guess if that doesn't illuminate kind of who we're dealing with here, then I don't know what does. And now we are here today in 2018 where John Bolton and the Republican Party are trying to fan the flames of war and saber rattle their way into World War III, which would be, Russia, China, and Iran versus the United States and NATO. And Canada got its nose dirty. And as a country, we locked up the Huawei CFO at the behest of the United States. So,
right.
Ajit, any thoughts on what we have so far?
Well, it's just a really interesting story. I think we saw articles that, you know, oh, Canada's in between, they're mixed in between these two trade giants. I saw this as kind of reaffirmation on Trudeau's end that, you know, we know which camp we're in, you know, we're not straying away from, you know, either or. Of course, he doesn't want to offend Chinese investors in any way, you know, threaten their large stakeholdings in Canada, but... you know, there's no doubt that it's funny because it's really interesting how they did it, because I think they kind of locked her up on the grounds that there was some human rights violations.
Even worse, it was part of the U.S.-Canada extradition treaty, so that if the American Justice Department asks the Canadian government to extradite a citizen, someone in their custody, they have to the United States. So, yeah, that is where.
But the grounds for arrest, wasn't it that she had been in violation?
Fraud. It was fraud of the Iran sanctions.
Okay, right.
The very dubious
some,
ones.
There were
the
some mentions of like human and the human rights were violated just because, you know, it's the little ruse Canada loves to, you know, always.
Yeah, somewhere. Oh, like, Canada, human rights. Oh my God, there's people being exploited somewhere out there. I don't know where. Right. And then as soon as it blows up in our face, they're not. So what I would like to discuss today is the Five Eyes and Huawei. So Five Eyes, this is a very...
Love these names.
This is like the most 1984, esque thing that is totally cool with everybody else. Weirds me out. I hope everyone else has got reactions like Five Eyes. I'm like, this sounds terrifying. Like, what animal has an odd number of eyes? It's badass, but guess what? You know, it's not helping us, Ajit. So until we have the people's Five Eyes and we have the workers' Five Eyes, until then we have the
whatever the hell this
the is. Ruling classes Five Eyes and the deep state's Five Eyes. That's basically who these people are.
Right.
So this is by Robert Fife and Stephen Chase of the Globe and Mail. The headline, this was published a couple days ago. The headline is Five Eyes spy chiefs warn Trudeau twice about Huawei's national security risk. So spy chief from the Five Eyes intelligence network briefed Prime Minister Trudeau on two occasions this year about the national security risk from Chinese high-tech giant Huawei, meetings that took place months before Canada's arrest of a top Huawei executive, severely strained relations with Beijing. Sources say Mr. Trudeau met the spy directors at a Five Eyes meeting in mid-July in Nova Scotia and at secret intelligence talks on the sidelines of the Commonwealth Summit in London in April, where Huawei and its ties to the Chinese government dominated discussion. The Five Eyes network is made up of Canada, the United States, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand, which cooperate to combat espionage, terrorism, and global crime. During the discussions in Halifax and London, sources said the spy chiefs stressed that their countries cannot become dependent upon Huawei's 5G technology because they view the Shenzhen-based company as beholden to the Chinese state. Under Chinese law, the country's companies must work with China's intelligence agencies if requested. Senior federal officials, including the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, would not discuss the Five Eyes deliberations in Huawei. CSIS will not comment on the nature or substance of meetings held with its Five Eyes partners. Canada's relationship with these partners remains strong and is focused on keeping Canada safe from a variety of threats, CSIS Chief Information Officer Tahira Mufti said in a statement. So, Mr. Trudeau is facing a difficult decision on whether to join the majority of his Five Eyes allies and bar Huawei equipment from being used in next generation 5G mobile networks. China's already upset with Canada's arrest of Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou at the request of U.S. law enforcement officials. Beijing has detained two Canadians, entrepreneur Michael Spavor and former diplomat Michael Kovrig, in what appears to be tit-for-tat reprisals. So, we got a lot going on here. So there's currently two Canadian citizens locked up. This is kind of what happens. And like, and my heart goes out to them because obviously they have little to do with what's going on. But, you know, you play with fire, you're going to get burned. And unfortunately, that's kind of what happens is when you do the United States bidding, is that you will be caught up in that. And China is flexing its muscle, saying that, you know, you're going to take one of ours, we'll take two of yours. And there's really nothing Canada can do about it. Obviously, China is one of the world's leading powers. It's the fastest growing economy on earth. It will surpass the United States. And focusing on that is where I think we're kind of where all the problems stem from. So in my estimations and what this is all about, it seems to be it's all about the 5G mobile networking. It seems that, at least from my observations, I'm working off the assumption that world power is not dictated by, you know, military might. It's not dictated by not even necessarily, you know, how much cash you have in the bank. in my opinion, it's dominated in how efficiently you can produce goods and services.
Right, and like control over resources.
Yeah, well, which are like interconnected. Right? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. You can, like, you could be an oil-rich country like Saudi Arabia.
Right, infrastructure.
Not the most powerful nation on earth. No. The most powerful nation on earth is the United States because they can produce goods and services like no other can. Their economy is the biggest. They produce the most things that people consume. And based on that, estimations of how the world really works is that, and you know, obviously this is all like this is all diplomacy problems, but it is rooted in this battle over 5G, and that Huawei is poised due to their, you know, the Chinese state capitalist economic system of really having no differentiation between public and private is why they're so far ahead.
Well, I think you mentioned it before tons of times that the way they're doing capitalism, it's just state-sponsored or state-facilitated capitalism or whatnot, that the corporation is the state. They're one and the same. It's just a different form of elitism. Very interesting, though. Right after the arrest happened, I think it was Australia, New Zealand, maybe England too, I'm not too sure, pledged that, you know, Huawei isn't going to get any access to their 5G networks or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And
from this dubious threat created by Five Eyes. So it's the intelligence agencies that are feeding this information.
Right.
Right. So it's like, it's so like shaky.
Well, I think, you know, going back to your grander point, I think, you know, due to the Chinese kind of distortion of what their economic system really is, the writing's on the wall, right? What, like, you look at the biggest corporations in the world. Recently, a lot of, you know, our good old American public corporations have been overtaken by the state, like State Bank of China, State Grid of China, just a bunch of Chinese companies. I'm sounding like Donald Trump because I'm saying China so much.
China.
But, right. And, you know, the writing's on the wall, you know, and, you know, they're fine because State Grid, that's related to their infrastructure, banking. Okay, everybody lends money. They're going to lend more money because they got money to lend, right? They got surplus, right? But, you know, telecommunications, you know, tech, that's our field, yo. That's the, you know, that's where they don't want to get impeded on.
Apple, $1 trillion,
right?
Deal with it.
And it's more, and it's kind of even more funny. You know, Five Eyes, they're like, they're kind of, yo, this is our playing field because I'm sure they conduct their surveillance through these networks.
Oh, of course.
Right?
Yeah, like, how do you think they spy on us? Right. Through American phones.
Interesting note about Five Eyes, it was actually created so, you know, all of us could spy on the other. You know, they're like, oh, I can't. It's unethical that I spy, even though I'm sure, you know, America since the Patriot Act has been doing it anyways, because who cares? But, you know, it's like the British spies on the Americans, American spies on the Brits, Australians on the Canadians, like,
you know, Chinese on the Americans, Americans on the Chinese, right. Canada, you know, everyone's spying on everybody. So, like, this whole, like, really benevolent and Five Eyes spy chiefs warning Trudeau, like, oh my god, stay away from these dangerous people.
Right.
It's like, no, it's our brand of dangerous people. Don't like their brand of dangerous people, not because they're dangerous, but because they're not us,
right?
You know, we're all cool, us Five Eyes. We don't like that set of eyes over there in China. That set of eyes is not okay with us. And realistically, you know, the future is 5G, where like all your electronics and everything electrical is connected to each other.
Everything's
and then,
digitized.
Yeah, right. And then China is leagues ahead. Maybe because they don't, I don't know, they don't subsidize massive corporations all the time. Maybe that was a good idea. Right. You know, maybe.
Well, they kind of do, though.
Well, but what I'm saying is, well, what I'm saying is that in America, they subsidize mass corporations so that they can put the money in their pockets.
And, you know, keep
in China,
the
it's like,
right.
It's there. Yeah, well, and there's unemployment problems all over the place. And in China, it's like, you know, don't get me wrong, this is not a pro-Chinese thing because, you know, let me just say that this is no workers' paradise, okay? We've all seen what happens in Foxconn factories there, okay? The people of China suffer under the state. But as far as like global politics is concerned, it's kind of like, it's kind of hard to watch Canada and America play catch up to China. And, you know, while we all pretend over here like that, we're somehow the victims, you know, Huawei is, you know, Hockey Night in Canada's sponsor.
Right.
So, I mean, we locked up the company that is allegedly spying on us, but also sponsors Hockey Night in Canada, like our national like pastime.
Right. It's really interesting. Their logo is really similar to the NBC logo.
It's kind of trippy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you look at the names of tons of Chinese companies. Why are they in English? Like, clearly their operations are, you know, back and forth across the Pacific.
Well, it's like, and that's the thing, right? Like, we're living in a transnational time where, like, it's not, these corporations don't have per se a home here or there. They're beholden to capital wherever that may be. And right now it's China. So a lot of it's centering on China.
Right.
And obviously the United States, because they're so corrupt and because they're so bad about, like, spending, I don't know, half their money on the military budget, doing crazy stuff like that, that they're lagging behind China. And rather than fix the efficiency, the inefficiencies in the American economy, which, you know, would be probably abolishing the parasite that is Goldman Sachs and Wall Street entirely.
Right.
That would probably be a good place to start.
They're not doing so well.
No. Instead, the country is run by Wall Street. It's run by the parasite. And then in China, they don't have that problem because China's state, like the Communist Party of China, runs the show, so there isn't that friction.
Right.
And rather than deal with, hey, America, how can we fix our free economy and the best economy on earth and the greatest country ever, you know, rather than fix that, they're just going to do very dangerous stuff, like kidnapping the CFO of one of the world's largest telecom companies.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, wait until she gets assassinated, and then we have Archduke Franz Ferdinand on our hands.
Right.
And, you know, Canada's like, uh-oh. Like, here come the missiles.
Right.
You know, there's been, people have died over less. So that's where I take a step back and be like, this is not good for anybody.
Right.
But this is what happens when spies are running our country.
I mean, I think this is part of Trump's template of how he, kind of his agenda, right? Like, war in general is, of course, unpopular, right? And, you know, like you said, it's one assassination away from, you know, God knows what, right? But this is how he's kind of, you know, getting his popularity up or whatnot, or, you know, getting that, you know, that whole patriotic rhetoric, which is so in line with jingoism and whatnot and militarism, is, you know, this kind of economic warfare is the term for it. Even though that kind of, it's kind of just shuffling pieces on, like, a chessboard is what it really is. And, like,
with no regard to, like, the impact. It's not like, you know, like, you put a chess piece on the board, it makes, like, a little sound in your room, but then obviously you move a chess piece in the real world.
Right.
Like, that could be, like, you know, 10 people dead, two Canadians in jail, or it could be like 1,000 people dead.
Right. And I mean, to the CFO, it's just part and parcel of her act too. I mean, it's the other thing.
Yeah, we don't feel bad for these people, okay?
No.
By the way, we're just saying how screwed up this whole thing is and how crazy it is, because, like, locking up CFOs is not a good idea for world politics.
No. And I mean, just on an unrelated note, kind of, I saw a picture of her house, right? It's probably out here on West Side Van. It's like a regular two-story house. I'm like, this is who's living in Vancouver real estate, yo. Like, Chinese CFOs. And she paid a $10 million bail like it was nothing.
Yeah.
And, like, it's just ridiculous.
It's crazy. But, like, that, hey, that's, this is unfortunately, you know, like,
it's Vancouver, yo. We're on the map.
Where we are intertwined with the highs and lows of world politics.
I bet we could, if we wanted to, let's say we just, you know, randomly stopped caring about rich people's money coming into Vancouver. I bet we could arrest a lot of people on grounds of a lot of criminal activity
here. And unfortunately, there will be no arresting of anybody, because guess what? Like, who writes the laws of this, of this country, you know? Who runs this country? It's not us. It's not like the rule of law does not exist.
It's political and economic elites, right?
Yeah.
It's their game to play.
And they're inflicting it upon whoever they please. So China locks up people for no reason. Canada locked up people for no reason. Like, that's where we're at. It's this, like, wild, wild west of 2018, where whatever the whims of the powerful are, just go. We have to take a short break for commercials, but after that, we'll be right back to talk more news and politics. So stay tuned.
Do you want to voice this one?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Do you want me to voice it? I can voice it.
Yeah, yeah. Please voice
this
one.
That's the wrong mic.
I forgot.
You dip. I can't believe I put up with this. And I asked for a grape soda, you asshole. Okay.
Due to a labor dispute, CITR is missing its star voice actors. That means if you're interested in producing PSAs, advertisements, and various other promotional wonders for airplay on the radio, we need you. Learn how to get involved with CITR's production department and all other facets of volunteering at CITR and Discorder Magazine at CITR.ca. Programming, photography, media training, and more. Plus, a guest star in the lounge. Nope, wait, we can't promise that.
Can't believe I put up with this.
The Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion, if approved, would create decades of intensive carbon emissions with the transportation of fossil fuels from Edmonton to Burnaby. The federal government and the National Energy Board are set to announce their decision on the expansion in December. An approval of the project would actively work against Trudeau's commitment to a 1.5-degree limit and global temperature rise, and would also put our local ecosystem at risk. If you'd like to get involved in the fight against Kinder Morgan Pipeline, check us out at ubcc350.org. That's ubcc350.org.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
Hello.
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And Ajit is going to pick up where we left off, and he's going to tell us something about Indian politics today.
Right. Getting out of North America for a second.
The epicenter of the world. Right. The global north. Eurocentrism is super important to me, so please break my European gaze with this Orientalism here.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Well, it's a BBC article, and I'll just read from this to kind of give context on what I'm going to be talking about. The title reads, Sajjan Kumar, Milestone Conviction Over 1984 Sikh Killings. The article's from, December 17th. Okay. And it reads, Sajjan Kumar, who was an MP at the time, was found guilty of inciting crowds to kill Sikhs. In a scathing verdict, the Delhi High Court judges said that the accused evaded justice due to political patronage. More than 3,000 Sikhs were killed following the assassination of then-PM Indira Gandhi by her Sikh bodyguards. They were angry at her decision to send the army into the Golden Temple, Sikhism's holiest shrine, to flush out militants earlier in the year. The killing of Mrs. Gandhi, who belonged to the Congress, which is an Indian political party, their version of the Democrats, you could say. Now, India's main opposition party saw mobs attack and murder members of the Sikh community across the country. The worst violence took place in the capital, Delhi, where more than 2,700 Sikhs are believed to have died. For 34 years, high-profile politicians accused of involvement in the anti-Sikh riots had evaded justice. On Monday, this changed with Sajjan Kumar's conviction. Kumar, 73, had been previously acquitted by a lower court for his role in the riots, but the verdict was challenged by the country's top investigative agency. Pretty much it goes on to say that he was convicted, he was found guilty, and he got life imprisonment, right? So just to give some context into this, it's a long, messy history, but what essentially happened was 1984, it was a really bad year for, my religious group, you know, Sikhs, right? Here in Canada or whatever, we call them Punjabi, ethnically Punjabi, but, you know, religiously they're Sikhs in India. But anyways, there had been this growing independent movement because, you know, we're kind of a small minority within a very large state, which is primarily Hindus and Muslims. And again, it's much more diverse than just those religious points too, but that's kind of some basic context. And, you know, coming from that, the military was sent into kind of our Vatican City, our Mecca, right? Our most holiest city. It's a very religious place, very sacred to, of course, to all the Sikhs in the world. And, you know, there was a military attack there, right? So you can just imagine the outrage in Catholics, right? If the tanks rolled into the Vatican City and, like, blew it up, right? So anyways, what led from that was that the prime minister at the time, Indira Gandhi, who had ordered for this, her bodyguards were actually Sikh. And they murdered her, right? Because, it's pretty obvious why. And that happened in October 31st, I believe. And what followed after that was pretty much essentially... So the terminology is a big issue, as it always is, right? Sikhs, you know, they like to stick to the term genocide because it was facilitated, this is the whole issue right here, it was facilitated by members of political parties. So what they did were Sajjan Kumar, and there was two others that they mentioned, Kamal Nath and Jagdish Taitler, they had voting lists of, because in Delhi and whatnot, it's neighborhoods are separated according to ethnicity, religion. It's still like that a lot. And what happened, they had voting lists of, you know, Sikh businesses and Sikh families and whatnot. And what occurred, you know, was a massacre, right? And it was very brutal. A lot of Sikhs were burnt alive. They were beaten. And it's kind of interesting to identify Sikhs. You know, I myself have a turban or whatnot. And that's how they identified them at the time. It was very obvious that literally having a turban on your head. In India, you know, it sounds so strange to say this in India of all places, you know, having a turban on your head at that moment in time. It was a death wish, essentially. And so it was just violence in the most horrific way. But, you know, what the greater crime, in a way, afterwards, were it was there were many witnesses who said that politicians such as his, such as this, because he was an MP, so he had access to the voter lists and information. He was providing that out to mobs, which were, you know, Hindu mobs, right? They were angry.
And Hindus are the other large group of...
They're the vast majority of India, of India's population. But they themselves are broken down into numerous state ethnic groups. But this is like North India, right?
Would you compare them to Christians? As like there's many Christian denominations, and it's like the largest like religion in North America,
right,
in the global North, so to speak.
Right, exactly. Part of the political project going on in India right now is to make them more of a monolithic group, because local identities will always kind of pervade over, you know, religious identities. It's just natural. Your locality kind of becomes part of you. But anyways, you know, this guy, it's 34 years late, and there were tons of witnesses, tons of testimonies given by, you know, not just Sikh people, but like people of all religious stripes, right? And including a lot of Hindus who find this totally despicable and disgrace on their country, and as it is, everybody's country. And, you know, the timing of this is interesting because there's an election going on next year, right? And so, you know, the Congress Party, which I said is their version of the Democrats, they like to talk about how they're very secular or whatnot. They like to, you know, appear as kind of that progressive left-wing party, even though they're at that time, they were dominated by many hardcore kind of militants, not militants in a religious sense, but militants in the sense that they didn't want some subversive religion, i.e. Sikhs, kind of messing up their project for, you know, this large nation state, which is India, right? Because it's been a project since after colonialism, right? It wasn't ever one single country. That's what kind of resulted in it. It was because the PM was assassinated and he's given life imprisonment. He's 73 years old. It's 34 years late. And, you know, the timing, everybody kind of notices it. And, you know, while I'm sure many people are very thankful, including those people, I mean, just hearing some of these testimonials, it just, you know, it's just the worst. You know, there was like this lady, her father was burnt alive, and then this other lady, five of her family members were killed. They specifically targeted the males, you know, because for obvious reasons, I guess. And what happened now, these communities have actually turned into ghettos. They're very poor, they're filled with poverty, because obviously in that part of the world, if you don't have any male breadwinners, you're essentially hopeless. You're a widow, you're poor, you're destitute completely. And so there's this widow's colony which has sprung up there, and these people have been relentlessly trying for 30 odd years, almost 40 years now, to find some form of justice, any form of justice. And so, you know, it is extremely delayed, in my opinion, in the opinion of a lot of people, right? But I just wanted to highlight this because, I think for like the Sikh community, I say like, this is that one, you might talk to a lot of, certain, Sikhs, and they don't really like India. They have like very strong,
I wonder why,
and, antipathy, towards the Indian government, especially not the Indian people, mm-hmm. or the Indian state, the Indian government. Cause you know, governments are the issue, right? Like we like to talk about, and of course corporations,
yeah.
One and the same, right?
And political economy of capitalism.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, I just wanted to shed light on this.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I will say that I personally have a blind spot to Asian politics. I don't really know much outside of, you know, maybe Mao's China, a little bit of Vietnam because of the U.S., but really nothing about India.
Right. I mean, you know, of course, it sounds kind of weird to get into statistical figures. I mean, of course, thousands of people were killed. This 3,000 figure is an undercount, I would say. I think most people have done estimates, and it's very interesting. BBC, I wouldn't doubt, they're very firmly in, aligned with the Indian state in their reporting, and that they don't want to offend too much. And it's very interesting, such a topic. It didn't come up on other news outlets or whatnot.
Well, and I feel like it says something about the BBC. Obviously, like they like to report on the world like it's still their, you know, right. still their empire, right, obviously. Right. And you know, it's clear how they're trying to play like to the politics of the current Indian government, which is very in line with the way that the world is turning, of going to a hardcore right-wing liberal populism that's rooted in more or less like ethno-nationalism and fascism, as Modi is kind of showing us.
Right. And it's interesting the fact that he himself, being such a staunch right-winger, he's kind of showing that, oh, I'm the one to deliver you guys justice. And it's funny, they say political patronage. I mean, come on, it's just downright corruption that he wasn't convicted for so many years. And, you know, the other guy who, the other high-profile politician who who they saw at the time, it was also giving out voter lists, inciting violence, actively encouraging the crowd, go out, find people who are six and kill them.
I saw in the article, he's apparent, Kumar was a part of a conspiracy of terrifying proportions with the police. So furthermore, to underscore the point where we talk about cops a lot on the show, same all over the world.
Oh, all over
India,
the world, right.
They're horrible. They're killing people. And they're part of these riots that had thousands of people dead. Thousands as a low, you know, as a generous estimation. So you see the connection to America where there's thousands of black people dead. So don't be surprised.
Oh, no, it's the same everywhere. But just that other politician, he's actually their version of a premier of a state. So, you know, it just shows you there's no shortage of political patronage, which is, you know, able to be given out.
Yeah, it's very selective enforcement. I mean, like, imagine if in Canada we locked up a politician who oversaw residential schools.
Right.
Or, you know, or oversaw the 60 scoop, you know, like, mm-hmm. would they ever end up in jail? Or, you know, how many American presidents were tried for their crimes in Vietnam, Cambodia?
Right.
None of those people, you know, in fact, George H.W. Bush kills 500,000 Iraqis with those sanctions. And he gets honored during Monday Night Football in the NFL. It's crazy. Political patronage is not an Indian problem. People.
No.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
I just love the parallels you drew because it was funny. I was in my little bubble there for a second, but thinking, you know what? This is the same thing we've been talking about.
It's
everywhere, right?
It's a global problem, people.
Right. And, you know, it sheds a lot of light, and, you know, I'm glad we're talking about this.
Yeah, no, I was blown away. I appreciate you sharing all this about, your Sikh identity. And I think, you know, that kind of explains to a lot of people why, you know, and like a lot of people care about migration.
Right.
Well, you know, maybe if there wasn't a genocide of Sikh people.
Directly related to this,
in India,
right.
They wouldn't have left India. And all these, you know, staunch right wingers like, oh, we don't want people leaving. We don't want people leaving their countries. We want people coming here. Well, maybe if you didn't support the genocidal leaders of these countries or other acts that will displace millions of people or billions of people, climate catastrophe, we wouldn't be dealing with this.
No, not at all.
It wouldn't even be a problem. Not saying that I have a position on either or. I'm just saying that this wouldn't be a problem if this did not happen.
Oh, I mean, on the note of climate change, I mean, you're talking about migration.
Climate catastrophe. The climate has changed.
Climate.
Ralph Nader told us to say climate devastation.
Right. Climate apocalypse soon enough. I think there's like 100 million people who live below sea level in India. So, you know, good luck.
Oh, you're afraid of a demographics change. Well, the world's going to be underwater. So how do you feel about that one? Yeah, I'm glad that we could take an example that I know like legitimately nothing about, because, you know, as an outsider, and this is what I hope that, you know, all listeners and people who are interested in politics is just keep an open mind. Look at other countries. Don't particularly have a bias that you like, I'm pro India, I'm anti India. Just take a real analysis of what's going on. You know, try to figure out who the powerful players are, where the resources are located, and what kind of system they're using, and what kind of legacy of, you know, maybe especially with India, British colonialism and genocide that happened. They starved people to death there. That happened. So now that you see this long history of, you know, of oppression, and you see it today, it's like, okay. And then you look at other places of the world with lots of oppression, you know, like our own country, and then you're starting to see it all starts kind of to fit together. And
it's
taking that concrete analysis of concrete conditions of anywhere in the world that can really flesh out how brutal capitalism, colonialism, racism are to regular people, and how it always results in genocide, in the dispossession of people from their land, for property,
from their homes,
from a future even.
Right, absolutely.
And that's how it all comes together for everybody. All over the world.
The most pervasive aspects of humanity are unfortunately our most negative aspect.
Yeah, and it's maybe it's because of a system that, you know, only exacerbates the worst qualities of human beings. So, you know, that's just me, maybe projecting that I feel like it's a systemic problem. It's not just India and they're doing favors
Orient,
for their
Occident,
buddies.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, it's we're all very brutal when it comes to one another. Ajit, any wrap up thoughts on this story?
I mean, I kind of said my piece. It's an evolving story, I'm sure. I think it's, you know, important to keep fighting for justice and anywhere, right? And it shows you the whole point we're saying, the treatment of minorities anywhere is bad. And then, you know, but we don't even mean ethnic minorities. We mean, you know, minorities along working class boundaries, mm-hmm. who are, of course, the majority in a lot of countries.
Linguistically, culturally, religiously.
If there's any way for people up top to punch down or people to feel some sort of power.
And to divide. To really divide people.
Right, because India's issue is communal violence, right? You get these villagers all riled up based on religion, right? Like, it's so ridiculous. And mm-hmm. that is, where it is race in America, it is religion in India.
Yeah, it's the opium of the people, as Karl Marx described.
Yes.
And adding on to that, just a little bit of perspective is seeing how, not necessarily, you know, I'm anti-religion or pro-religion. I really don't actually know much about it, nor do I care much for it. I'm more interested in other things.
Right.
But it's really important to see how religion or race or gender, sexuality, these things are so easily divisive in society. And then you see who, you know, taps into this, which in the case of Sajjan Kumar is the Indian political elite,
right.
Tap into those divisions that are in society,
right.
To their own gain. And I see it rather than as just this, like, oh, it just explodes randomly, you know, like Sikh people and and Hindus, you know, just randomly
and
explode.
Muslims too.
And Muslims. No, it's not random.
Right.
It's when there's political goals, when there's resources to be gained, when there's some way to exploit the situation that the elites, you know, use their power that were given to them generally by the people, right? So these are government officials. They're democratically elected, I guess. And they use that position to incite violence against the people through, you know, manipulating them through religion, something that is like integral to their lives.
Absolutely.
Which is really cynical and disgusting.
But I mean, it's the truth. And just one final point, totally seconding what you're saying. There's nobody who's been more, as a group, counterproductive to the progression of sick people, but the sick elites, right? Because who do they align themselves with?
The Hindu elites.
The Indian political elites, right?
Yeah.
You know, at the top, I love this quote, there's no race, there's no religion, there's only wealth, right?
Exactly. There's no nations for oligarchs.
Right.
I mean, look at Obama, right? You know, is he helping, you know, did he help out poor migrant children? No. He was the deporter in chief. You know, did he free black people from prison? No. There's still private prisons to this day. The police are still killing people in the streets.
He visited one, okay?
He went inside a prison, which was nice, and he freed all of zero prisoners, which was also very nice. And, you know, you could draw these parallels where, you know, you just basically, I could write an ad libs kind of thing, a Mad Libs thing where I could just put, like, you know, politician X from like the majority group did this to, you know, like group Y because they are the minority in power and resources.
Right.
It doesn't really matter.
It's opportunism.
Yeah, it's opportunism. And it's also just building your own power for your own group through whatever means you choose to do so. And it says a lot about elitism in general, which is why I personally am against a class society at all, because when you get that, you get people with power, and then next thing you know, they're trying to start just straight up genocide between groups of people, which is so counterproductive to humanity. And we all deserve better, and we all deserve to at least have politicians that aren't going to pit us against each other to keep the world running. So
word life.
Straight up. That's all the time we have today. I hope you enjoyed the topics. If you want to hear anything else, or you want to add your own a commentary or something, contact me, Spencer Latu on Facebook, Spencer Latu on Instagram as well. I'd love to hear from you, and you can email me at spencerlatu@gmail.com. If you want to hear more of the Spencer Latu Show, you can check us out on Apple Podcasts, iTunes Podcasts, and the iTunes Podcast app. Check out the Spencer Latu Show on there if you want to hear from our backlog. We have some interesting topics, and also an interesting interview with Travis Lupik if you're interested in hearing from a local Vancouver writer on the opioid crisis. So we'll be back not next week, as that is Christmas. Merry Christmas to you, Ajit, and Merry Christmas to all of you, the listeners, and Happy Holidays to all the people who haven't, who are still fighting the war against Christmas, against Christmas. So
keep on fighting.
Keep on fighting the good fight.
Hi, this is Amanda. I'm the drummer in Adrian Teacher and the Subs, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM.